Welcome to Pod Summarizer, the way to summarize your favorite podcasts. Today, we have a summary of Crime Junkie. In this episode, host Ashley Flowers and co-host Britt return from their tour to share a poignant story that highlights the unresolved case of Peggy, a loved one lost too soon. They explore the emotional weight of regret and the urgent call to action for justice. This episode delves deep into the complexities of loss and the hope for resolution. Remember to follow us on X and Instagram and on our website, podsummarizer.xyz. And now, let's begin.
Hi, Crime Junkies. I'm your host, Ashley Flowers.
And I'm Britt.
And we are officially back from tour. It's been a long couple of months.
But so much fun.
Let us get on the road, get to meet the fans. Mm-hmm. But this was such an incredible story. I mean, collective gas. And it's one that has a very strong call to action that we need your help with. So for those of you who couldn't make it on the road, we wanted to bring this story to you as well.
How could this have happened to us? But, you know, over the years, I see so many people losing loved ones. And the one question that keeps coming back to me is, if we had done something different, if we'd stayed in Hawaii, if we'd stayed in Spain, this would have never happened, you know? Why did this happen? What brought us here to this place, you know, for this to happen? There's so many multiple universes, you know? We could have stayed here, stayed there, moved to Florida earlier, and she would have been alive today. It didn't happen that way. Why? I don't know. I don't know. But I wish we would have done some things differently. Yeah. In my lifetime now, it's been 30-some years since Peggy's gone, and still nothing has been done about it. And it's like everybody just wants to turn a blind eye to it and move on. What? Move on? I've got stage 4 colon cancer. I'm doing all right now, but my doctor has told me, and she was very blunt about it. She said, you know that this is going to kill you. And I said, yeah, I know that. I understand that. So that's why I agreed to do this interview, because I may not be around before this comes to a conclusion. You know, but I'd like to see it start. I'd like to see them get busy and do their job and make give Peggy resolution. You know, maybe me, maybe I'll still be around. I don't know, but I'll try to be around. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid of anything anymore. I can't be. I have to be strong and if we can do something for Peg and her memory, then let's get it done now.
All right, the man you just heard speaking was Tom Hetrick. And his sister, Peggy Hetrick, was murdered in Fort Collins, Colorado back in 1987. And the thing is, there is still plenty that can be done to solve this case. The problem is, the people who are in charge right now, who have the case, aren't doing what needs to be done to solve it. But our Crime Junkies know what helps with that, right?
Mm-hmm. A little bit of pressure.
And a lot of noise. And so the reason we went on tour, the reason we're bringing this story again, is we want to tell people why they should be making noise, why they should be straight up mad, not just on behalf of Tom and Peggy, but so many people in our story. And it's a story that starts on February 11th, 1987. That's when a guy named Woody is bicycling to work. It's like 7 a.m. And even though it's February in Fort Collins, Colorado, like there's no snow on the ground, but it's cold. So I imagine he's just like head down, like pedaling, kind of in the zone where you like, you know, zone out a little bit. Yeah. But then something catches his attention, like in this field. And when he looks down, he sees this splash of red. But he realizes it's not just red. This is blood. And so, forget work, like, he has to call police. And when they show up, there is this 100-foot-long trail of blood from that splash of blood by the curb all the way to the middle of the field. And that's where they find the body of a woman. Now, she's laying face up. Her arms are over her head. Her bra and her shirt have been pulled up. Her pants and her underwear have been pulled down. And they can't see like what's causing the blood. They suspect that she has some kind of wound to her back, but they won't know at the moment. But what they can see is that one of her nipples has been removed. But everything else is still on her. I mean, her clothes, she's still got her purse like slung over her shoulder, and everything is inside it, including her checkbook, which is how they realize she's 37-year-old Peggy Hetrick. Now, by 9 a.m., this field is a frenzy with officers. One of the people on the scene that day, Sergeant Ray Martinez, he said when he showed up, he was surprised to see basically all of Fort Collins Police Department there on the scene. He's like, this was an all-hands-on-deck situation. The problem is, in 1987, not all of those hands were gloved. But when they actually touch her and turn her over, they see that they were correct. There's a wound to her back, a stab wound on her upper back that was causing the bleeding. And they also see that she has like grass and debris on her butt, which they start forming this kind of theory based around what they're seeing. Because if you follow that blood trail all the way back to the curb, what they see are some critical things. So they see a set of footprints, not Peggy's footprints, by this pool. And then they also see a cigarette butt in the pool of blood. And Peggy was a known smoker. So they start to wonder, maybe she was like walking, got surprise attacked from behind. Like she's walking and smoking. She drops the cigarette and her attacker like pulled down her pants and then drug her. And they're thinking that because of the grass and stuff found on her butt. Mm-hmm. They're also thinking that because there was not just the bloody drag mark, but there was also this trail where you could tell that something was like drug in the dirt, and they suspected that it was her shoes. Mm-hmm. And I was literally like, at one point you saw me dragging people across the audio truck office.
Yes.
And the only way that makes sense is like, because normally if you drag someone,
your feet kind of splay out into a V.
Exactly. So I think the reason they're thinking this is like she had to have had her pants down first, not because of the grass, but also because to make these marks.
The shoes were like together.
Right. The problem I have with this is there's something that doesn't make sense to me. If they're dragging her and she's bleeding and her shoes are making this trail, those should line up. But the drag marks and the blood trail are actually very different. And at one point, they even cross each other, which nobody can seem to really make sense of. I mean, I've heard some people theorize, well, maybe there's two people. And what if one of them had her coat and the coat was bloody?
But my problem with that is, like, her coat isn't just on her. It's on her with her purse still over her shoulder. Like, no one, like, undressed her and then redressed her that much.
And it's also not the coat that's actively bleeding. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, the blood is coming from her, and for it to make a 100-foot-long trail, it just doesn't add up. And maybe it's a red herring, or we're not understanding what those are, because the other thing I noticed is that Peggy's shoes don't seem really dirty in the photos that I have. And not that it was muddy or anything like that.
But there should still be like dust and pieces of grass.
As the mystery deepens with the perplexing details of Peggy's case, the narrative shifts to her family's heartbreaking decisions, revealing the emotional turmoil that followed her tragic fate.
When they did come back, they split up. So her brother and her dad went to Florida and Peggy went to Colorado. And I probably because like they'd lived there before, it felt familiar to her. And I know that no one sees something like this coming, but there's something about the timing of this that feels especially cruel. Because just 2 days before Peggy was murdered, she called her dad and she told him, "Dad, I had this dream that I moved to Florida to be with you. Like, I was so happy. I feel like that's where I'm supposed to be. Mm-hmm. Can I move there to Florida?" And her dad said, "Of course. Like, wherever we are, you are welcome. Like, that is your home." Mm-hmm. But, like, Peggy couldn't just drop the phone and go. Like, that's not real life. Mm-hmm. She had a job. She had an apartment. She had all these things that she would have to wrap up. But fast forward 2 days, and instead of helping her plan a move, her dad and her brother were now planning her funeral.
You feel like you've fallen into an abyss. One day you have sure footing and things are stable and she's going to be down there and our friends down there were going to find her a job, to help her find a job, and she was going to live with us and be a bright spot in the house and we'd be a family, to an abyss, like going into the ocean, you can't breathe and you just sink away, far away, without stopping. And so now your life is changed forever. What do you do, you know? Hopes and desires are, they go out the window. Now you have to start a new life. And then after that, you know, my dad started to get sick. Now I'm dealing with my dad that is dying, because the doctor pulled me in. He said, your dad maybe has 6 months. And I just looked and I said, what?
So Tom and his dad, they end up moving to Colorado so Tom could take care of his dad, also so they could be close to the investigation. But they weren't really getting a ton of updates. I mean, they kind of just got the party line, like this is active and ongoing. But that became harder and harder to believe as a lot of time went on, and really hard to believe when out of nowhere, Tom gets this call from someone at the police department who's like, hey, we have a bunch of your sister's stuff. Like, if you want to come get it, like, we'll probably just get rid of it. Like, up to you.
Which, the only thing police would have that's belonged to Peggy is evidence.
Fully evidence. But he's like, yeah, well, I mean, we'll take anything you have. So
yeah. He
goes down to the police station. They take him to this, like, garage across the street where they pull up the doors and they pull out two plastic bags with two paper bags inside and just hand it to him. And when he gets home, him and his family start to, like, open it up and go through it. But they realize, I mean, this stuff still has blood spatter on it. Mm. So they have this moment where they're like, I'm pretty sure we shouldn't have this.
Right.
And they kind of try their best they can to package it back up and store it in case. But in case of what? Because nobody comes asking about the evidence. Nobody comes asking about Peggy. And most of the updates that they're getting are from the media, when those even happen, few and far between. So it seems like nothing on the surface is happening. And behind the scenes, it's really a lot of the same. Jim Broderick is still convinced that Tim Masters killed Peggy. And in all that time, where it's years now, Tim had been busy growing up. When he was 18, he joined the Navy, just like his dad. And for him, this was his chance to start over, to, like, have a clean slate, to not be the kid suspected of murder. Like, he could go, put his head down, do the work. And that's what he did. Day in, day out, month after month, year after year, all the way up until 1992.
I'm told to report to the master at arms first thing in the morning the next day. I'm like, well, this is weird. I report to the master at arms office the next day, and the E4 that's assigned to escort me somewhere is like, should I put him in handcuffs? They're like, no, that's not necessary. And I'm going, what the hell? Handcuffs? He takes me over to the Navy Intelligence Office in Philadelphia, and there I'm met by three detectives from Fort Collins Police, Hal Dean, Jim Broderick, and Linda Wheeler. And I proceeded to endure about a day and a half of interrogations. I didn't recognize them right. I didn't know Linda Wheeler. I didn't recognize them until, so Jim Broderick had this habit of wearing, like, reddish color deodorant, and he had pit stains. And when I saw the pit stains, I recognized him. And so I remember my thought was, what the hell? I can't believe it. 5 years later, I'm still being harassed over this. I didn't have anything to do with this. And then, but I was still under the mindset of, especially, I'm just an E4 in the Navy. I really respected, I really treated authority with respect. And Linda Holloway, well, she's Linda Wheeler at the time, Jim Broderick, they were still authority. I still treated them with respect. And I kept telling myself, they're just doing their job. After the interview with Linda Wheeler, I had put it all behind me. I thought it was over, and I thought the Fort Collins police knew I didn't do it, so I didn't even think about it.
When investigators came out of that meeting with Tim, they were split in their thinking. I don't know what Hal thought, but Linda left thinking, no, like, this isn't our guy. We've got this all wrong. Jim Broderick, though, was more convinced than ever. So in 1996, he reopens the investigation. And after some time, by golly, he's got it. And so on August 10th, 1998, 27-year-old Tim is at home in California. He's out of the Navy by this point. And he gets this knock on his door. And he gets up to get it. Before he can reach the door is open. And there is this police officer standing right in front of him.
And he said, are you Tim Masters? I said, yeah. He said, you're under arrest. I said, what? What for? And he wouldn't tell me. And he handcuffed me. And as he's taking me out the door, Jim Broderick meets me there and he goes, you're under arrest for the murder of Peggy Hetrick. And I went, phew, what the hell? You gotta be kidding me. It was a complete shock.
It was a shock to everyone. I mean, like, I think people were looking like side to side, like, wait, what did we miss? What do they have that they didn't have before?
What's new? Yeah.
Well, Tim goes to county to talk to his lawyer and he realizes nothing. What they have are his drawings and a star witness to talk about the drawings.
Lieutenant Broderick provided me with approximately 2,200 pages of drawings and narratives produced by this young man before and immediately after the sexual homicide.
With the shocking revelation of Tim's arrest still lingering in the air, the narrative shifts to a pivotal moment as a determined individual steps forward, seeking to uncover the truth behind the case.
I should do something. And so he takes just that one next step. He didn't know what to do, but his one next step is he wrote to Tim in prison. And he's like, listen, I see it. Like, how can I help? And Tim's like, man, I don't know, but if there is someone that can help, you have to get Linda Wheeler. Go talk to Linda Wheeler. So Taylor takes the next step and he writes to Linda.
He said, you know, you don't know me, but do you remember Tim Masters? I said, sure. He goes, well, do you think he's possibly innocent? And I said, yeah, I really do. But what can I do? You know, I'm done. I'm not even a cop anymore. And he said, I talked with him. I just communicated with him by a letter. And he said, I bought all the transcripts of the trial, $900 worth. But he said, they don't mean anything to me because I don't read legalese. He said, could I send them to you? And for the first time, I sat there and read what happened at the trial. And I was infuriated because I knew this case and I knew the jury had not heard the truth. And at that point, I went, okay. So I contacted Maria Lou, who was Tim's attorney. And I said, you want my help? They said, yeah. I said, okay, but I know what I had to do is I had to put back on a badge because I knew I wouldn't have any credibility as a civilian.
Now, as you can imagine, Fort Collins PD is not like welcoming Linda back with open arms.
She's telling them the wrong.
Yeah, she's trying to like upend a case that they're like overdone with. It's solved.
Yeah.
So she ends up going to work for a DA's office with the understanding that she's going to work on Tim's case part time. Now, she knows by now a lot of time has passed, and if they're going to point the finger at someone else or even just prove Tim didn't do it, the best way to do that is DNA, something they didn't have access to in 1987, but they do now. And she remembers meeting this woman named Selma at a conference before, and Selma and her husband Richard have this independent lab out in Holland. And independent is key because at this point, they trust freaking nobody. Yeah. And so now the wild part is like, they can't just go testing stuff. Like most crime junkies will know this, but if you were wrongfully convicted and you think there's DNA evidence, you do not have the right to just test it on your own.
The prosecution essentially owns the rights to the evidence against you.
Yeah, the people who put you there. Now, luckily, there's been enough like sus stuff happening that Fort Collins PD has recused themselves. Larimer County, which is the DA's office, has recused themselves. So there is a new DA that they're going to have to appeal to, a guy named Don Quick. And they're hoping like this guy has no dog in the fight other than just wanting justice. Mm-hmm. So Selma and Richard come to the U.S. They do this like 4-hour presentation in front of Don Quick. And by the end of it, Don's like, yes, I love you, love the lab, love what you're doing. Like, go Justice. But guess what happens next? That DNA evidence they were going to send off gets destroyed.
And I just want to point out exactly what you said. This happens next. So this evidence destruction happens after they get permission to test it. It's not like, oops, we don't have the evidence anymore. It's gone. It's, oh, you want it? We're getting rid of it.
Which is like they were already, Tim and his team were already suspicious that something sus was going on. And now they're more sure of it than ever. So they do end up finding some stuff that they can send off. At some point, they had gone back to Tom and gotten the stuff that they gave back to him.
Like, the stuff, like, the evidence?
They're like, you shouldn't have this. He's like, I know. So they like at least collect that. Thank God he saved it. And they end up sending some stuff off for testing. And at the same time, because they're convinced something like very fishy is going on, his lawyers make a request for a new trial based on the accusation that Tim's rights were violated. And they make four important points in this filing. Number one, they say crucial evidence was withheld from Tim's defense team. And they point to two things. They say specifically the prints, and I think they're talking about the shoe prints in the field, the Tom McCann ones by the pool of blood on the curb. Apparently they never knew, like his defense team never knew that those existed. The second thing that they didn't know existed was that first FBI profile that the police had done that said, Tim is not your guy. Didn't know that that was a thing. That kind of just went away, which would have been really helpful in a trial. Their second point in this filing was the whole DNA destruction thing.
Like, there's that.
There's that. And then the third is apparently there was like a mishandling of some skin cell DNA that they had. So some evidence that they had, but you know, not only destroying things, then you're mishandling things. Like so much is useless. Mm-hmm. The fourth is that they ignored viable suspects, other viable suspects who were not Tim, because make no mistake, they did not just pick Tim out of a void. There were other people that looked a lot more promising than Tim that his defense team never knew about. And I'm going to be getting into those people in a moment. But those are their four points. And as they're uncovering all this and filing this, I mean, they found out other things as well. Like the police were basically waging psychological warfare on this kid. So remember how I told you that in the like first month of the investigation, you know, the newspaper's showing up every day. It's like, we've got our guy, we're honing in. Turns out that was not real. The Fort Collins police was making a fake front page of the newspaper, just one, putting it on the newspaper and delivering that newspaper to Tim's house.
Literal fake news on his doorstep.
Mm-hmm. And their whole theory about matricide, right, is Tim's like so upset about his mother's death that it caused all of this. Mm-hmm. So clearly they like know that he would be upset. They had like his mother's obituary reprinted at, like over and over. They would cut it out, put it in envelopes, and then like leave those envelopes around for Tim to find. And then when that didn't work in like the very like first early days or whatever, come the 1 year anniversary of Peggy's murder, they concocted this scheme. Some might call it an operation. It's a scheme. And a lot of the paper trail of this has been lost along the way, like so much in this
case.
But what is left behind is just, it's bizarre. So Fort Collins authorities basically reached out to the FBI around the 1 year anniversary and was like, hey, we feel like we have this guy. We can't prove that he's violent, but we feel like if we put him in the right situation, we can push him to be, and other people will see what we see. But we're afraid that if we push him too far, like, ooh, like if he might kill someone again. So we need you watching him. But if it goes too far, you have to pretend like this didn't happen.
With the unsettling details of the investigation lingering in the air, attention now shifts to the potential suspects, particularly Peggy's complicated relationship with Matt Zollner, whose alibi may not be as solid as it seems.
When talking about people we should be looking at, viable potential suspects, the first that comes up is Peggy's on-again, off-again boyfriend, Matt Zollner, who was 29 in 1987. And every detective, I think, has their, like, person, right, that they look mm-hmm. into the most. And for Linda Wheeler, it is Matt. Now, Ray Martinez, one of the detectives we talked about who was, like, first on the scene for Peggy's case last time, he said a lot of people were quick to write Matt off, maybe because of his behavior, like he was acting how they expected, maybe because he had an alibi. If you remember, Matt said that he had met that woman, maybe Sean. Again, mm-hmm. just met her, didn't even remember her name, but he was with her till last call. Then she's at his place till like 3:30 in the morning. And a lot of what you'll see about Peggy's death is that she died between 1 and 3 a.m., which, yes, Matt would have an alibi. Except when we got access to a lot of the investigative files, what we realize is in the report, it's actually a wider range. I mean, they settle on 1 to 3, but the true range of time is between 1 a.m. and 5 a.m., meaning that there's potentially an hour and a half, 2 hours yeah. that Matt is unaccounted for if she died like in those like later time frame. The other thing, which I haven't told anyone yet, been saving this up my sleeve, is that when Peggy was found, in her purse was a note that she had written to Matt, seemingly that very evening she died. And so, Britt, I'm going to have you read the note.
Matt, I need your help. Sharon has got my keys and isn't home. No answer. If I have to knock on your door at 2, please don't be a grump. I don't want to spend the night sleeping in the hall. Peg. But this note is in Peggy's bag. Like, Matt doesn't have it.
No, no, this is in her bag. And so there are a couple of lines of thinking around this. So we know she gets locked out, right? So I think everyone's thinking she gets locked out, she writes this note. And then one of two things happens. Either she goes and like puts this on Matt's door, and then she goes out, she ends up getting back into her place, and then goes back to Matt's and collects the note because she no longer needs to show up at his place at 2 a.m. Or she writes the note, goes out, ends up getting back into her place before she ever drops the note off.
Doesn't need the note at all.
She's in, it doesn't even matter anymore. And it's like a moot point. It's like living in her purse and maybe she forgot about it. I don't know.
And did Matt see the note? Like, what did he say about it?
That's the thing. So based on the files that I've seen, it doesn't appear like they ask him about it, which like maybe they're just writing it off. But to me, it feels like it feels really interesting. Like, did she plan on coming to your place? Did you know she was planning on coming?
Did she mention it to you? Like something? Yeah.
Right. And we know they spoke and that like him, her coming to his house was never a part of the story he told when they spoke. So just a reminder of his story. So Matt actually lived even closer to the prime minister than Peggy did. So there are like, you know, two possibilities here. So Matt drove that night because he was kind of bopping around to different places. And he said that when he got to the prime minister, Peggy was arriving at the same time. They are like at the bar. They're chatting for a little bit, like everything's normal. And then his date, this girl he's supposed to meet up with, comes. Again, maybe Sean is her. He thinks is her name. They just met that night. And he says that he offered Peggy a ride. She said yes originally, but then like at some point in the evening, he went to the bathroom. He's coming out. Peggy's leaving. So he's like, oh, she must have changed her mind. Whatever. He stays till last call with maybe Sean, and then they go back to his place till 3:30. Now, he does tell police, though, that even though their conversation was normal, it was great. She made mention, Peggy did, that she was seeing someone new during this time, which he thought police should know.
Which you haven't mentioned that at all. So my question is, like, was she actually seeing someone, or was she seeing her on-again, off-again boyfriend, Matt, with someone new? She's like, oh, I too am newly in love. He's so hot and so rich.
So tall, better looking than you.
Don't even worry about me. Yeah. Like, was she bluffing?
I don't know. I don't know. So there's like some indications that maybe she was seeing someone, like casually. I think it's also important to know that like Matt is that guy she would always go back to there in Colorado. Mm. And so much so that I found out that earlier in that week, I mean, they had had dinner together. Also, apparently, though, as far as I can tell, not something that police asked him about, which is like seems like a miss to me because like they're very much in each other's lives. And like, what did you talk about? What were the days leading up to it? I don't know.
Well, and the police don't ask about the note. They don't ask about this dinner within like the week before she died. Did they even ask about his alibi?
They did. They did check his alibi. They found maybe Sean, and our reporter, Emily, actually found her all these years later and spoke to her. Turns out, maybe Sean, her name is actually Dawn.
Matt, you were so close.
So close. And her story is interesting. It adds a little bit of context, a little bit of color. She says that they really did just meet earlier that night. They had saw each other in another bar, and she said they recognized each other because Matt, like, a while ago had sold her a car. So, like, they'd been in the same orbit before, but didn't even know each other's names, clearly.
Yeah.
She said Matt came over to her and was like, hey, you know, when you're done with your friend, you should come to Prime Minister and hang out with me, which is what she did. She says she shows up later in the evening, and when she walks in, Matt is talking to this other woman who she figures out later is Peggy, didn't know Peggy at the time. And she says she kind of hangs back for a little while and waits, but a couple minutes go by, he's still talking, so she decides to approach him. As soon as she approaches, Peggy, like, turns at the bar and starts talking to the guy next to her. And so Dawn just made the assumption that Peggy was with that other guy. And Matt doesn't introduce Dawn or anything. He just is like, hey, go get a table. So Dawn goes to get a table for four, thinking that maybe the other couple is going to join them. But just Matt comes back. And she says she didn't ask him about it. She didn't even ask him about the woman when she realized Matt's, like, kind of keeping an eye on her all night. Like, they just met. She doesn't know the history, but, like, she's not going to dig too deep. They're, like, having a decent time. And they do. They stay till last call. She goes home with Matt. They talk. They kiss a little. She says the night ends for, like, a combination of reasons. Like, you know, he's doing the, like, oh, like, I gotta work in the morning. And then he also makes this comment about how he hates kids. Like, not, like, dislikes kids. Like, hates them. And Dawn is like, well, I have one of those. So this probably isn't gonna work out. And so she ends up leaving. But when she talked to us, there was something else that she told us that really stood out to her.
As the night unfolded with unexpected twists and realizations, the conversation shifts to the complexities of evidence in legal cases, delving into the nuances of DNA and its implications in the courtroom.
I don't think that at this point you can take a case to trial just based on that one piece of DNA. There's a lot that has to be explained at this point. I mean, and again, it's touch DNA. You don't know how it got there, when it got there.
And it's only one of the profiles that was found on her.
Yes. And we know that they had contact, right? Like, they're going to dinner. They saw each other that night. Mm-hmm. I think it is important. I think it is meaningful. And I think that is, like, when you talk about a lead that tells you where to focus, I think that's telling you where to focus. However, there is other DNA that's going to have to be explained away. There is, you're going to have to prove it in a court of law, and there's legwork that can be done. You also have, when I think about DNA, the Missy Woods of it all. If anyone mm-hmm. remembers our JonBenet Ramsey episode, there is a DNA tech in Colorado who was there from 90s to 2023. Mm-hmm. Her name's Missy Woods, and she was like, there was like
not following protocol, mishandling evidence,
exactly.
Not storing things correctly, like
right.
Not necessarily falsifying things, but really mucking up the system.
So all of her cases are getting called into question. I don't know if she touched this. And I know we sent some stuff to Holland, but stuff was stored in Colorado. Some of it was tested in Colorado. Mm-hmm. Again, I'm only saying all of this because while I think this DNA is important, you are going to have to back it up with legwork.
Well, and for me, like, Matt doesn't have this history of violence. Even if it was something that happened in the heat of the moment, she was mutilated with, like, surgical precision.
I know.
That doesn't, like, you don't learn that in, like, a heat of the moment situation.
We asked about that, and people who believe that Matt did this, they think that maybe he was trying to, like, throw people off his trail by doing that.
But the precision of it.
I know. And listen, who's to say there isn't a world where someone killed Peggy and then someone else came along and did something, right? Mm-hmm. Like, Richard Hammond had insomnia and could see that field from his bedroom window. I don't think he wants to call police and alert them to what he's, like, doing in his place. You know what I mean? I don't know. But it might not be. The reason that a lot of things might not fit is because maybe there isn't just one answer. And another problem that we're going to face when it comes to, like, making a case is that, like, you will have this Richard Hammond thing that is, like, very open-ended.
Again, it can never be buttoned up.
Right. We don't know if Peggy was on one of those tapes mm-hmm. because some powerful people made sure we would never know what was on those tapes, who was on those tapes. Mm-hmm. And if you came to the live show, this is where we started to wrap things up. But I mean, as a lot of people might have noticed by now, like the theme of these stories is going a layer deeper. So while Britt and I were on tour, I sent some of our reporters back to Colorado to do some more digging, some more door knocking and like boots on the ground work, mostly because I couldn't shake the feeling that there is more to this Dr. Hammond story. Like
as it relates to Peggy or like something else?
I don't know. The way that everyone made it go away so fast and like the operation we learned he had set up feels so much bigger. So, Britt, we got our hands on some investigative reports from Hammond's case, and I was disappointed to see that police just straight up stopped investigating after he died.
I mean, not surprised, but I disappointed.
Again, at the time, they said it was all to protect the victims, blah, blah, blah. But the question I have is, like, no one can say for sure that Hammond didn't sell or share the tapes. What we learned is that his video setup was professional, it was elaborate, and his tape catalogs were organized like a library. And Hammond would even label the tapes by like date, by victim's initials. But some of the tapes were also labeled ready.
Ready for what?
I don't know. Distribution? To go somewhere? Our reporting team tracked down one of Hammond's victims, and she filled in some blanks for us. And prepare to be disappointed yet again, because she told us that not only did police never ask their opinions on destroying the evidence, which we assumed, but when detectives were interviewing the victims, they were asking these victims if they were in on it.
Like, in on it? How exactly?
The cops were asking these teenage girls if they were performing for the cameras. Like, did anyone tell you where to stand and like what to do? And on top of that, she said that Fort Collins PD never once offered to let these teen girls have a parent or trusted adult in the room with them during their interviews. So it just feels like the victims have never once had a voice in that case. Like every decision was made for them, even after the cops basically treated them like suspects. Oh, and remember how I told you, like, we found out that like there was a file that said some of the DA's office had socialized at Hammond's, might be on the tapes, whatever. Well, when we finally got to track down Judge Terry Gilmore, that was obviously one of the things we asked him specifically about. We weren't able to talk to anyone else. And he confirmed that the destruction of the tapes did go against regular policy. And he admitted to knowing Dr. Hammond personally before his arrest. But he says that he only socialized with him one time and that he was never at the doctor's home. And that's kind of where that ended.
Okay.
And then there's one more thing that I want to mention before we wrap things up on Hammond. So we got a hold of a woman who in 1988-ish went to the eye clinic where Hammond worked for an emergency. Like her son got like Sandy Snowball lodged in his eye or whatever. Now, Hammond is not their regular doctor, but he was the one on call that weekend. So they're alone in the eye clinic with him. And Dr. Hammond was treating the boy. He's like 9 or 10. And his mom had to use the restroom. So she went to the closest one that she could find, which was the men's stall. But Dr. Hammond came and like physically blocked her from using the men's restroom. And he insisted that she had to use the women's restroom. And she's like, okay, like whatever, dude. Yeah. And when she got inside and flipped the light switch on, she heard this like whirring.
So this is in 88. Mm-hmm. No one knows and won't know for years about Hammond's secret taping hobby.
And what they ended up determining at his house is like it's the light switch. So he, like when you turn it on, that triggered it to start recording. So he didn't even have to be there. And she's hearing this at his office. Now, she says in the moment, she was certain it was a camera. Not even like years later, but in that moment. Like specifically one of those big cameras from the 80s that had that distinct sound when it turned on. Specifically when it focused. Mm-hmm. And she even flipped the light switch off because she was like so freaked out. She was like looking for a red light or any sign that she was being recorded.
Wait, did police find cameras at his practice? Or, I mean, did they even search it?
So it depends on who you ask. Ray Martinez told us that they didn't. But our reporters found an old article at the CSU archives that said they did search the doctor's office. But that article also had some other wrong information in it. So I don't really know for sure.
If we even know. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Ray Martinez like worked the case. So like I want to trust him. But like it's also been so many years. You never know. So anyways, fast forward 7 years. And this woman is like seeing the headlines about Dr. Hammond's cameras in his basement. And she's like, she has this like, oh, my God moment. Like it, what I thought was real.
That's it for today's summary. To stay up to date with more summaries and news, follow us on X and Instagram and visit our website, podsummarizer.xyz. If you have any comments, questions, suggestions, or complaints about the content displayed, please do not hesitate to write to us at info@podsummarizer.xyz. Thank you for listening.